From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, why it's looking more likely that life exists elsewhere in the universe. Washington Post science writer Mark Kaufman explains how recent research has convinced many astrobiologists that there may be planets with conditions that are or once were suitable for life, including Mars, where newly found methane gas indicates that microbial life may have existed on the red planet 4 billion years ago.
Mars was probably a lot more hospitable to life than Earth was, a fact that makes some people think initially there was life on Mars and it came in some microbial form to Earth, meaning that we are all Martians.
Kaufman is the author of First Contact, Scientific Breakthroughs in the Hunt for Life Beyond Earth. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Paul Simon's new album, So Beautiful or So What? That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's no longer fringy to think that there's life on other planets. Our guest, science writer Mark Kaufman, says that since the mid-1990s, interest in extraterrestrial life among credible scientists has blossomed. The field of astrobiology includes researchers from a wide variety of disciplines, microbiologists studying bacteria which survive in the most extreme conditions on Earth, astronomers who believe there may be billions of planets with conditions hospitable to life, chemists looking to how amino acids and living organisms first appeared on Earth, and scientists who study rocks from Mars and see convincing evidence that microbial life existed on the red planet. Mark Kaufman is the author of the new book First Contact, Scientific Breakthroughs in the Hunt for Life Beyond Earth. In addition to writing about science, he's national editor of the Washington Post. He spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies.
Well, Mark Kaufman, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much for having me.
Before we talk about Mars rocks, and I want to talk about them a good bit, let's talk about life that is growing in extremes environment on Earth, extremophiles you call them, like 2 miles into a South African mine shaft where you descended. What's growing there?
These are little microbes that have not had any relationship with the surface for tens of millions of years. And by that I mean they don't feed on anything that received sunshine and created organic material as a result. They live in a world of utter darkness that has no relation to the surface. And the way that the energy source that they have is the radioactive decay of some of the rocks nearby. And using that energy, they break apart some molecules, and that is their food. It is something that no one imagined possible not too many years ago. And now there's good reason to believe that this kind of life exists just about everywhere, very deep down. It's just that they find it in South Africa because that's where the deepest mines on Earth are, and the mine owners have allowed these researchers to go down there.
So when you said these are microbes, that means what? They're single-celled organisms?
Yes, they're single-celled organisms, although when I was down in South Africa, I was with a group that included a Belgian nematodologist. Nematodes are these little roundworms that are multi-celled, that have nervous systems, that have digestive systems, and he is convinced that he has discovered them down there as well. They feed on the other little bacteria and microbes that would be there. So it is primarily a single cell world, but that may be just because that's what they've looked for and found so far.
Okay. Now, can they move? Can they reproduce?
Oh, yes. And they may not reproduce a whole lot, but yes, they can move. They believe that the one that is most famous, the Audax viator, has a leg, as it were, that allows it to reach out and move and then get whatever it is that it's looking for. So, yes, they live in cracks in the rocks or sometimes deep under the ground. There would be a lake, a pond, whatever. They would live in those. And the way that they come out or that they are found is there are boreholes that are put into the mine wall by the miners, and water comes out of that, and they collect the water, and they take the samples back to the lab, and then they look for them.
So we have these microbes growing miles beneath the surface of the Earth, been there millions of years, live in total darkness, grow slowly, do reproduce. Why is the existence of these microbes relevant to the subject of extraterrestrial life?
This is kind of the beauty of it all. On Mars, it is pretty clear that the surface of the planet gets too much radiation. It is too cold. It's too inhospitable for life. But there's a strong feeling that there once were conditions on Mars that would have been conducive to life. And so the logic is, well, gee, maybe there is microbial life deep down in the below the surface of Mars, just as there is in South Africa and no doubt elsewhere in the on Earth. So it's kind of a proof of concept, if you will, that an organism does not have to have any kind of connection with the sun in order to exist.
And what are some other extreme environments in which you find these microbes on Earth?
Perhaps the most remarkable from my perspective is, and who knew this, but in a glacier, in a deep, thick glacier in Antarctica, there will be locked in the ice, there will be microbial life. The ice forms little crystals, and around the crystals is kind of a little river of water, if you will, and everything that isn't H2O goes in there, and that includes microbes that have been found again several miles down in Antarctica in the ice. They've also found them, and this was where the world of extremophiles first was explored, at the bottom of the Pacific Ocean in something called black smokers, which are these huge vents that come from the bowels of the Earth. They're upwards of 750 degrees, and they're spewing out all kinds of material. And in the water surrounding it, not right near, not right at the point, but nearby, would be life forms that are living deep down and in this extreme environment. Further, they now know that there's microbial life floating in the atmosphere and surviving and reproducing. There's microbial life in extremely acidic and extremely alkaline environments like Mono Lake or a place called Rio Tinto in Spain. So essentially what they have found is that anywhere that there could be life, there is. And that is an important piece of this whole logic that says the likelihood of there being extraterrestrial life is extremely high.
These microbes that exist deep below the surface of the Earth or in ice in Antarctica or in the atmosphere or at the mouth of volcanoes, are they all descended from microbes in other parts of the globe? And are they all descended from the single-celled organisms that we came from if you go back a few billion years?
Absolutely. I mean, that is the remarkable logic of it, that somewhere, somehow, and this is part of astrobiology too, it's not just life beyond Earth, but how did life begin on Earth? As the building blocks of life came together, they formed the original single-cell organisms, and those over the eons evolved into you, me, cats, ragweed, everything. And that, again, is when you look at it in the context of other planets, is why scientists think that there probably is life and that there's every reason to think that it would evolve. If it evolved on Earth from single-cell microbes, which were the only things on Earth for the first 3 billion out of the 3.8 billion years of life on Earth. But then they evolve and most likely would do the same thing on other planets.
You know, an interesting question arises here. I mean, we've been talking about microbial life and complex organisms. What do we mean by life? Do scientists have a common definition?
This was one of the things that really surprised me as I dug into the subject, that there is no consensus whatsoever. There's something like 350 different or more different definitions that have been put forward. NASA has a definition that it uses in an informal sense, and it has to do with being a chemical mechanism that can metabolize and evolve in a Darwinian fashion. But that definition would leave out things like viruses and prions, which is what mad cow disease comes from or is created by, and a variety of other things. As I was kind of making my way through that conundrum, I came across a woman named Carol Cleland out at the University of Colorado in Boulder, who had been part of a number of astrobiology projects that were sponsored by NASA. And she had posited that it was impossible to define life, that we had no more an ability to define life today than people back in the Middle Ages had to define water. They would look at the aspects of water, the characteristics. It was a solvent. It was clear. It didn't smell, so on and so forth. And that's how they defined it. And there were some things that were not water at all that got classified as water simply because they met those same criteria. And her view is that today we also don't know enough about life to be able to say what it is. And her view, which was first put forward about 10 years ago, was kind of revolutionary, and not a lot of people liked it. And I describe a meeting where she first brought it up and people were yelling and screaming at her. But now it's pretty much accepted as being the truth. And I was talking to the head of the Mars program for NASA and asked him the question about what is life. And he said that at this point, they would almost use the same definition that the Supreme Court would for pornography. You know it when you see it, but you can't go past that. It's a remarkable thing. There are a lot of different characteristics that people would agree on, but there's nothing that everyone would agree on.
Okay, well, if I find something that moves and reproduces, I'm going to call that life, I think.
Okay, there you go.
But let's ask a more basic question. Do we understand how life began on this planet? And how close have scientists come to creating life out of non-living chemicals?
We do not know how life started. We're getting closer and closer to some kind of a sense, but it actually will never, ever be determined because the traces are gone. It may be that sometime in the future, they will be able scientists, synthetic biologists, will be able to create an organism that can reproduce itself, that can replicate an organism that was not living before, but they could make it live in the sense of replicating its DNA. But no one will ever know. We will never know how that began, probably 4 billion years ago or so on Earth, because the evidence is gone. But remarkably, looking for life beyond Earth is probably our best window into learning how it started here.
Well, I mean, there have been experiments that offer some insight into what might have happened, right? I mean, there was this fascinating experiment in 1952, which was new to me, I'm sure not to scientists in the field. Tell us about that, the Stanley Miller experiment.
Yes, the famous Miller-Urey experiment. Prior to 1952 or so, there wasn't really an understanding, a scientific basis for understanding how it was that non-life became anything close to life, or how even the components for life were put together. There were some scientists who had made a stab at it, but it hadn't gone very far. What he did, Stanley Miller was a graduate student then, although he was working with Harold Urey, who was a Nobel Prize winner. And what he did was in this jury-rigged set of tubes and vials, he put in a variety of different kinds of gases that were believed to be to exist at the time of early Earth, like carbon dioxide, hydrogen, and so on. He put in some water, and then he sparked it. And this, over a period of time, created or formed as a residue amino acids, which are themselves not living, but they are the building blocks for life. That's what proteins and DNA comes from. You need them, and they don't necessarily exist in the environment unless they somehow get formed. And that is what he did in a kind of a revolutionary sense, was to say we didn't have to have creation to start things. We didn't have to have some kind of spontaneous accidental event. There are processes in nature that with the right combinations of material and energy could create some of the building blocks of life. And the extension to that was – and perhaps all of the building blocks of life, so that they could then come together.
We're speaking with Mark Kaufman. He is a science writer and national editor for The Washington Post. His new book is called First Contact. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, our guest is science writer and national editor for The Washington Post, Mark Kaufman. He's written a new book called First Contact, scientific breakthroughs in the hunt for life beyond Earth. Let's talk about Mars. One of the things that we know that scientists knows about Mars is that there is methane. And why is that significant?
90% of the methane that is produced on Earth comes from biological sources, from bogs, from cows, from you and me. And it's a gas that they had not known until 2 or 3 years ago. They had not known for sure was even in the Martian atmosphere because there are other materials there that that destroy it fairly quickly. But a remarkable researcher at NASA's Goddard Space Center named Mike Mumma has, over a period of 20 years, done the work to determine that there was, in fact, methane that was being released at specific places at specific times on the Martian surface. And it tended to be what were considered old spots where there was still a remnant of the magnetic field, where volcanoes and other things had not changed the environment. So in other words, those are the areas that go back to the time 4 billion years ago when Mars was probably a lot more hospitable to life than Earth was, a fact that makes some people think that we are – that it is logical to think that initially there was life on Mars and it came in some microbial form to Earth, meaning that we are all Martians. But in any case, the methane that has been discovered, they're still in the process of determining what its origin is. But going back to what we were discussing earlier with the extremophiles, it is quite possible that that these are called methanogens, microbial life that produces or lives in methane. And so now you have, coming from beneath the surface of Mars, you have methane at particular times in particular places, and we know that life on Earth can exist that deep. So it's, again, putting one and one together, and we're starting to come up with some bigger numbers.
Now, is there an alternate explanation for finding methane there, one that doesn't involve, you know, life and biology?
Yes. There's a mineral called olivine on Earth, and as it degrades or interacts with water in various ways, it produces methane. There are some other minerals that are like that as well. And so there are explanations that are not biological.
But the likelihood that they might explain it on Mars is what?
We don't really know that yet, but we do know that on Earth, 90% of the methane comes from biological sources. And so it's at least a serious contender that it's biology that's producing methane on Mars.
Is it a scientific consensus that Mars once had water and may still have?
Yes. It's now, I think, broadly accepted that there was water. And when the NASA's most recent lander was on Mars, the Phoenix, they found water ice just below the surface. And through other satellites going around Mars, they have found a lot of hydrogen just below the surface, and they believe that that is most likely hydrogen, frozen H2O. And that comports with the other understandings that suggest that Mars was, as they say now, wet and warm back 4 billion years ago.
So we know there was water on Mars. We now find methane there, which might have come from a biological source. And the other interesting thing about Mars, which you write, which, again, I didn't know, it used to have magnetic poles, but not anymore. Where did they go and why do we care?
Okay, let me start with why do we care? The magnetic fields, the magnetic poles, serve the function of keeping an atmosphere in place. If we did not have magnetic fields around Earth, we would not be here. And the atmosphere that is held in place then serves as a protector against the really dangerous, deadly kinds of radiation. It also keeps in place the gases and the chemicals, the molecules that are needed on a planet in order to have, one, a temperate climate, and then two, to have other kinds of activity, both chemical and biological. So absent a magnetic field, you're not going to have an atmosphere. And absent an atmosphere, you're not going to have anything that's living.
Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies will continue his conversation with science writer Mark Kaufman in the second half of the show. Kaufman is the author of the new book First Contact: Scientific Breakthroughs in the Hunt for Life Beyond Earth. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Angie's List, providing consumer reviews on local professionals from physicians and veterinarians to plumbers and roofers. Details at angieslist.com. From Chevrolet, undertaking a carbon-reducing effort, investing in projects like planting trees across America at chevycarbonreduction.com. And from LendingTree, providing multiple loan offers from a network of lenders. Learn more at LendingTree.com or 800-555-TREE. This is NPR.
Coming up, more with science writer Mark Kaufman about new evidence that has top scientists saying that exoplanets, planets with conditions that can support life, are much more common than previously thought. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Paul Simon's latest album, So Beautiful or So What? This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to the interview that Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies recorded with science writer Mark Kaufman about why an increasing number of scientists believe there is life on other planets. Kaufman is the author of First Contact: Scientific Breakthroughs in the Hunt for Life Beyond Earth. He's a science writer and national editor for The Washington Post.
Now, there have been several spacecraft sent from Earth to Mars, and I guess the earliest were the Viking missions in 1976, right?
That's correct.
Right, and you know, a lot of people don't know this, but these things orbited, they landed, and they were able to scoop up soil samples and analyze them, perform some tests. And that led to an initial conclusion that there might be living things in that soil. Explain what led scientists to believe that.
Okay. Let me backtrack just a sec, just a bit before. Prior to the Viking trips, journeys, there was a pretty strong consensus that life on Mars was likely to have existed and perhaps still did. When they arrived in Mars and landed, they could see that it was very parched, but they began their experiments. And the first one, or one of the early ones, was something called label release. The principal investigator was a gentleman named Gil Levin. And what they found was that they got a reaction that NASA had determined before the journey would have been consistent with life. It's a fairly simple experiment, but we'll just leave it at that. It was – the finding was consistent with there's something living here that is create – that's metabolizing.
Right. I mean, didn't they actually heat a soil sample and then discover there was what, carbon dioxide?
Carbon
released?
Dioxide. Yes. That was – that had the same radioactive signature that they had in the material that they put in, the liquid. So in other words, there was a food source and then ostensibly something ate it and then gave off this radioactive CO2. This was such a remarkable discovery that it was, as it should be, it was early on very rigorously tested. There was a great deal of skepticism within the Viking team. And then additional tests were done on Mars by Viking that showed ostensibly that there was no organic material on the planet. Organic material being carbon, hydrocarbons, carbon and hydrogen and oxygen. And if there was nothing, if there were no hydrocarbons, then how could there have been life? And how could there have been this metabolism that was detected? So that experiment, the one that showed no organic material, ultimately trumped the other one that said that there had been life and that there had been a response that was living. And again, interesting to look back on it. As a result of those tests, and first the great enthusiasm to say that they had found life, and then the concern, the counter argument, the result was that the consensus evolved that there was no life. And that really is what held pretty firm for 2-3 decades. They said, you know, we did the test. It came up negative. No life.
But it's changed. Why did it change?
It changed because they have found increasingly those the evidence that there was water. They have found that there was the evidence of materials of minerals on the Martian surface that can be created only in the presence of water. They now know that there is this liquid, that there is ice underneath the surface, and now they also know that there's this methane. Putting all that together, plus a number of other discoveries that they've made, they're beginning to piece together something that says, well, yeah, Mars may be a, you know, a pretty hard neighborhood to live in right now, but it's possible that there's life below the surface, and it's possible that there was life sometime in the past.
Right. And as, if I recall, a closer look at the test which concluded there was no organic matter discovered. In fact, with the testing equipment, they might not have gotten it in the concentrations that existed, right?
Absolutely. And this is one of the things that's so both interesting and frustrating about science. It moves forward and then it moves back and moves forward and moves back. Tests that are done and are believed to be determinative turn out to not be. And that is part of the process. And I came as someone who was not trained in science, I came to really greatly respect that process that everything is challenged. That is absolutely what is expected for every major discovery and minor discovery. And the challenge goes on for years and years. And for something to really be accepted as consensus scientific knowledge, you need a lot of tests to have gone through. So when it reaches that point, that it's probably true.
Okay. Now, some of the really fascinating stuff involves evidence of Martian critters on rocks, meteors that have made their way to Earth. You want to tell the story of David McKay?
Absolutely. He was or is a researcher down at the Johnson Space Center at NASA and in Houston. And he was not, if I remember correctly, was not a meteor specialist to begin with, but a sample was brought to him. And some, I guess this was in the early mid-90s, a sample of a meteor that clearly had meteorite that clearly had come from Mars, and there were a number of very interesting aspects to it, in terms of potentially showing some kind of faint biosignatures. He put together a team. This was done very hush-hush for a period of time, and they ultimately concluded that there were six biosignatures that together, each one in and of itself, did not mean that there was life in that, that there had been life in that meteorite, but rather all together, they said, it made a very strong case for there having been life on Mars. Again, this was in the period, I believe, about 4 billion years before. And that story just broke extraordinarily, went around the world. David McKay publishes this this extraordinary data. There's a huge reaction. And then gradually over time, it is pecked apart. The consensus is that it is not accurate. I had long conversations with David. He is 100% convinced that it is accurate. He's done a lot more work on better samples and is convinced that he is seeing microfossils using an electron microscope. So in other words, he is seeing the remnants of what was once bacterial life on rocks that clearly came from Mars. The issue is whether or not it's somehow is earthly contamination that he's seeing, but he is convinced that it is not. So this is a story that had this huge moment. It faded, and I have to think it's going to come back again.
We're speaking with Mark Kaufman. He is a science writer and national editor of The Washington Post. His new book is First Contact. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, our guest is Mark Kaufman. He is a national editor and science writer at The Washington Post. His new book is First Contact, Scientific Breakthroughs in the Hunt for Life Beyond Earth. So if there is or was primitive life on Mars, why should that lead anybody to conclude that there is highly involved intelligent life out there? I mean, that's a big leap. What's the logical link?
The logical link goes like this. If there was just one genesis of life and it was on Earth, then you know you could try to figure out how and why that was, but it's a significant limitation. If it turns out that there is more than one genesis of life, even in our little solar system, our, as we are now finding, very typical kind of solar system, if it turned out that life that's different than Earth initiated on Mars and perhaps evolved to some extent, then the people in this field say that that cannot be coincidence. That means that life is a commonplace. So even if you find one little microbe that clearly is different than microbes on Earth, then the logic says that life is not only common but almost inevitable because of the various large forces in the universe.
And a single-celled organism might reasonably evolve because of natural selection into something much more sophisticated.
Absolutely. I mean, that's, again, what happened here. We were 3 billion years of single-celled organisms, and then things changed, and so it was us. No reason to think that that wouldn't have happened somewhere else where there was a single microbe.
Now, I guess it makes a big difference whether there are a handful of potentially habitable planets around the universe or a few dozen or thousands or millions. And that's one of the other interesting areas here. People are discovering new planets. Tell us about what they're finding and how they look.
Okay. This is another of the main legs of the stool, as it were. You have the logic of why there is almost certainly life beyond Earth is you have extremophiles that show how life can exist in really harsh conditions. You have Mars being most likely habitable at one point. Now what they're finding is that planets like Earth, like potentially Mars, are themselves a common place. And this is new. This is over the last – it began in the mid-90s, but it really is the last 5 years that things have picked up enormously. Most recently, just a few months ago, the results of the Kepler mission, which is a NASA mission, came back with – preliminary findings of a solar system with six planets orbiting a star and with, I think it was 1,200 new candidate planets. You have some of the top people in the field saying that there are undoubtedly billions of or trillions of planets out there and that there are most likely billions in the Milky Way itself, just one of billions of galaxies, that there are billions of planets in habitable zones in relation to their star that would allow for water to be liquid and for other kinds of important conditions for life. So this is, again, entirely new information over the last 10 years that says – what people surmised but never knew, but now they do, that exoplanets are common, that exoplanets in habitable zones are common, and that's a phenomenal change.
If there are these, you know, billions of planets out there, which might be somewhat like ours or might have at some point been somewhat like ours, how are scientists going to know what's there? I mean, they're so far away.
That is one of the major issues in astrobiology and also in terms of how that relates to resources and NASA. There are methods of determining what is in an atmosphere of a planet hundreds of light years away. They know, for instance, that there is carbon dioxide in some, in methane and others. They use spectrometers in order to do this. But in terms of whether or not there is life there, we're not sure yet that we have the capability. There have been plans, NASA plans, to send out satellites that would be able to determine these kinds of things, but they're very expensive and they've been kind of put on the back shelf. But the kind of result that they're looking for is if you find an atmosphere that has a lot of oxygen or ozone in it, oxygen is something that bonds very quickly with other elements. And if there's an excess of it, if there's tons of it like there is on our planet, then that means that there's biology that's creating it because otherwise it would have disappeared quickly. So that is kind of the holy grail of exoplanets is to find a way to determine whether or not there is a lot of oxygen or ozone or something like that in an atmosphere.
One other fascinating little aspect of this is scientists who are peering into the universe, listening for radio signals from intelligent life from distant worlds. Now, how do they do this and what might they hear?
This is the whole world of SETI, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, which started about 50 years ago. For a long time, this was at the kind of borderline between science, and we're not exactly sure what. Very kind of famously, in the early 90s, Congress took away any money that might ever go to SETI because they thought that this was a ridiculous thing. They've subsequently, not Congress, but the Bush administration, restored the ability for SETI to receive money. But what there is now is in Northern California, an array, probably I think the largest radio telescope array in the world, that is listening for signals coming from other planets. It's a joint venture with the University of California, Berkeley, which does other radio astronomy. But the logic of this is that they are tuning in to different parts of the sky, and now to parts of the sky where we know there are stars with exoplanets, to listen to see if there's any signal that's coming from them that would be identifiable as intelligence. There's a big controversy in this field now that's fascinating as to whether or not they should also send out signals.
And it was fascinating to read that some people believe you should send out messages hoping for a response. Others are strongly against that. Why?
Yeah, Stephen Hawking is perhaps the most famous person right now who is against that. He said, you know, the history of powerful beings is that when they find others who perhaps aren't as powerful, they come and exterminate them. And they likened it to when Europeans came to North America and elsewhere. But his view is, let's let well enough alone and not send out messages, because the chances that that entities that are somehow malign is too great, that chance. And so we should just listen.
Yeah, well, it was fascinating that, you know, you note at some point how long the odds are. I mean, if life has existed on Earth for 3.8 billion years and human beings have been able to send these signals out only about the last 50, you know, the chances that we would be sending our signal out at the right time that an evolved being from someplace else was shooting something back, kind of remote.
And absolutely. And this was one of the really fascinating joys of writing and researching and writing the book, which was to get a better understanding of where we are in the big picture of things in terms of the time that the universe has been here, the distances, just the sheer number of stars and planets and so on. We are so infinitesimally small. The amount of time that we have been here on Earth is just, you know, less than a blink of the eye. And when you step back and look at that, and kind of take it in, then suddenly a lot of the other forces, dynamics, possibilities that seemed unlikely somehow seem more likely.
Well, Mark Kaufman, it's been really interesting. Thanks so much.
You're quite welcome.
Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies spoke with Mark Kaufman, who's a science writer and national editor for The Washington Post. Kaufman's new book is called First Contact: Scientific Breakthroughs in the Hunt for Life Beyond Earth. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews Paul Simon's new album. This is Fresh Air. For his new album, So Beautiful or So What, Paul Simon has put together 10 songs he said he hopes will reintroduce the album as an art form to a generation that now gets most of its music as single-song downloads. Rock critic Ken Tucker also hears a strong spiritual theme running through the album. Here's Ken's review.
Love is eternal, sacred light, free from the shackles of time. Evil is darkness, sight without sight, a demon that feeds on the mind. How did it all begin? Started with a bang. Couple of light years later, stars and planets sang. Fire won the cold, waves of colors flew. Moonlight into gold, earth to green and blue.
Paul Simon will probably never again achieve the combination of artistic and mass audience success that he did with Graceland in 1986. That album's blend of singer-songwriter mannerliness and African adventurism was, at the time, novel, warm, and welcoming. Simon has characterized Graceland as rhythm-based, and he continued to make solo albums in this style, in part because it was a way of acknowledging the emphasis on beats brought about by hip-hop, without humiliating himself by trying to mimic mostly black musicians decades younger than himself. That was admirable, but it could only go on for so long. Thus, Simon has proclaimed So Beautiful or So What a return to singer-songwriter mode, with an emphasis on story songs and his earnest, chalky vocals. Still, he's not about to give up a good rhythm when he comes up with one, as on the album's catchy opening tune, Getting Ready for Christmas Day.
From early in November to the last week of December, I got money matters weighing me down. Well, the music may be merry, but it's only temporary. I know Santa Claus is coming to town. In the days I work my day job, in the nights I work my night, but it all comes down to working man's pay. Getting ready, yeah, I'm getting ready, ready for Christmas Day.
There's always been an aspect of Simon's talent that could be called the assiduous English major. His unremarkable thoughts about life and love, argued with impeccable meter, have long characterized his solo recordings, and they find a new self-consciousness in Rewrite, a song that uses his laboring over lyrics, tossing out first drafts, as a metaphor for rewriting one's life. This one is so immaculately crafted, it was printed as a poem in The New Yorker, where it worked as a kind of Billy Collins, Frank O'Hara wannabe piece of verse. As music, it ambles along, trying and failing to disguise the truth that rewriting one's life is a cliche best left inside self-help books.
I've been working on my rewrite, that's right. I'm gonna change the ending. Gonna throw away my title and toss it in the trash. Every minute after midnight, all the time I'm spending, it's just for working on my rewrite, that's right. I'm gonna turn it into cash. I've been working at the car wash, I consider it my day job, cause it's really not a paid job, but that's where I am. Everybody says the old guy working at the car wash hasn't got a brain cell left since Vietnam.
One element that jumps out at you as you listen to this album is its unifying theme of spirituality. That's both an aesthetic choice. It's what he means when he says he wants people to listen to this project as an album, not just a collection of downloadable singles, and an odd strategic one. There was probably more spiritual nourishment in Bridge Over Troubled Water than in the whole of this album. But evoking God and Buddha in the song called The Afterlife, having God and, quote, his only son pay a courtesy call on earth in the piano-based Randy Newman-ish Love in Hard Times, positing love as, in another song title, Eternal Sacred Light, and pondering in yet another composition Questions for the Angels, well, what is this? Is it sincerity that dovetails with those in his generation who are seeking a contemplative life in current hard times? Or is it a convenient way to puff up his songs with an exalted importance, when this crafty old pro knows that nonsense syllables like bebop-a-lula and bebop-a-wo can really serve the same function?
Love and blessings,
simple kindness fell like rain on thirsty land, fields and gardens long abandoned came to life in dust and sand. Lovers lips sweet as honey touched as if old love was new. Bankers' pockets overflowing with gold and money, prophecies of wealth come true.
Whatever the reason, Paul Simon has made an album that succeeds in blending the two best strands of his solo career, the articulate navel-gazing of his 1972 solo debut and Graceland's Rhymin' Simon in Rhythm. And only a few songs here could use the heavy hand of a rewrite.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large at Entertainment Weekly. Paul Simon's album, So Beautiful or So What, will be released April 12th. Until then, you can hear the full album streaming on the website nprmusic.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Fred Snyder. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Melody Kramer. John Sheehan directed today's show. I'm Terry Gross.
I'm gonna make a chicken gumbo, toss some sausage in the pot. I'm gonna flavor it with okra, cayenne pepper to make it hot. You know life is what we make of it, so beautiful or so what. I'm gonna tell my kids a bedtime story, a play without a plot. Will it have a happy ending? Maybe, yeah, maybe not. I tell them life is what you make of it, so beautiful or so what.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from AMARC Foundation, supporting procon.org, a website for teachers and the public to explore the pros and cons of controversial issues. From the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. And from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, working to help families earn it, keep it, save it during Financial Literacy Month, on the web at aecf.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, the smallpox epidemic at the turn of the 20th century and the civil liberties questions raised by mandatory vaccinations. Sometimes poor people and African Americans were forced by policemen to be vaccinated. We'll talk with Michael Woolrich, author of Pox. Join us.